What's up out there, everybody? I hope you're all fantastic. We're continuing our journey through the business operations and the filmography of Touchstone Pictures today. Now, the Walt Disney Company was struggling to close out the 70s and heading into the early 80s, and with the aim of releasing films for more adult audiences, Disney would create the banner of Touchstone Pictures. I recently dove into the very early years of the studio and their growth into a box office staple in the prior two videos of this series. I will leave them linked here for you guys to check out if you missed them, but today we're rolling right along into 1988, where Touchstone would release 10 more movies and just solidify their dominance at the box office. So let's get into the behind the scenes and on-screen history of Touchstone Pictures in 1988. Now, much like they did in 87, Touchstone Pictures would have a solid 1988. They kicked the year off with Good Morning Vietnam going wide and just pulling in a ton of cash from all the hype that it had built up from the 87 award season. Touchstone Pictures would have some big splashy commercial hits in 88, as well as a few quiet successes and a few failures as well, but their filmmaking formula that I covered in the prior videos was still proving to be a winning recipe for box office gains. Now, for Touchstone's first new release of 1988, we need to step back into April of 85, where Columbia Pictures had been working on a wilderness set action thriller with the working title of In the Hall of the Mountain King. By the time March 86 rolled around, development had halted and Columbia labeled the project as inactive. Fast forward a year into March of 87, The Hollywood Reporter listed the film as having a new title, Mountain King. Touchstone Pictures liked this project. They made a deal. It got done. The movie would go into production with principal photography beginning in April of 1987. Shoot to Kill, known in many countries as Deadly Pursuit, would center on an FBI agent who teams up with an experienced trapper to hunt a killer who has disappeared out into the wilderness after jumping in with a group of hikers. This would be the first performance from screen legend Sidney Poitier in 11 years, and alongside him would be 80s and 90s staple Tom Berenger, with Kirstie Alley, Richard Masser, and Clancy Brown filling out the strong supporting cast. This action thriller would hit theaters on February 12th to take the number two spot behind Good Morning Vietnam, which was just still cruising right along in the number one spot on its eighth weekend. Shoot to Kill would earn mostly positive reviews, with critics praising the performances and the direction, while those on the negative side sort of dinging the film because of its formulaic plot. However, just loved this movie. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. This movie felt like it was kind of set in my backyard. I loved the action. I loved the suspense that it delivered. And as I get older, I greatly appreciate the on-location shoots and just the pure natural chemistry that you get between Poitier and Berenger. Audiences enjoyed this movie as well. Shoot to Kill would spend 3 weeks in the number two spot and pull in a respectable $29.3 million on a $15 million budget. And I think this movie still holds up great all these years later, because it just delivers nonstop thrilling suspense and plenty of high energy action.
You almost got me shot. Most girls wait a lifetime for a date like this.
Just a month later, Touchstone's next movie would drop into theaters with the mystery thriller DOA, a remake of the 1950 film that had been adapted a few times over the years before this one. This version starred Dennis Quaid, Meg Ryan, and Daniel Stern. And for those of you who don't know, it centers on a professor who is poisoned and has 36 hours to find out who did it, which is not going to come easy as his health begins to fail. So this was certainly one of those few attempts Touchstone would make in the niche film genre. DOA would be released on March 18th and received mixed to positive reviews. I'd never watched this one entirely through until making this video, and overall it's decent. I like some of the experimentation with film techniques, and some of the manipulation of the lighting is cool. The color kind of slowly washes away from this movie as the story gets deeper into the plot, and it's okay. It feels a little bit gimmicky, I would say, with everything else going on in this one, but overall, I enjoyed this movie, even if I have no desire to watch it again. DOA would land in the number three spot with a $3.8 million weekend, and during its short 3 week run in theaters, it would pull in $12.7 million on a $3.5 million budget. So while not blowing the doors off the bank, DOA did finish in the green, which is a success for a niche film that was never going to have a ton of commercial appeal anyway. So only 3 months into 88 and Touchstone Pictures was more than already holding its own as a box office heavyweight. When DOA would be released, Touchstone Pictures would have three movies in the top 10 with Good Morning Vietnam, DOA of course, and Three Men and a Baby still earning. It seemed even if Touchstone delivered a film that critics were unfavorable of, the movie would still turn a profit. Now, some of this could be chalked up to just the common disconnect between film critics and general movie-going audiences, but more so it was just a show of just the result of the booming business of cinema. During the 80s, multiplexes were popping up all over the country. With every shopping mall came a theater. With every new suburb further from the metropolitan hub, a new movie theater was going in as well. And during this time, just going to the movies actually meant something. People would go to see whatever was out, and the power of word of mouth would either make or break a movie more than what critics ever had to say. This is how commercial films could last in theaters for months, particularly during the summer season, and much like they did in the summer of 1987, Touchstone had a lot planned in 88, and their first of the season was a comedy that they hoped would be a big commercial hit.
Are we gonna let them swoop down on us like a bunch of turkey buzzards in business suits?
Bette Midler would knock another film off of her Touchstone contract when she starred alongside Lily Tomlin in the high-charisma comedy Big Business, a film about two sets of identical twins, one set out in the country, the other set out in the big city, who through a comedy of errors will learn that they all have a much deeper connection to one another. Big Business would land in theaters on June 10th, taking the number 3 spot with a $6.1 million weekend, and it did come out during some strong summer competition with movies such as Crocodile Dundee 2 and Big and Rambo 3, but it would hold its own. This was clearly alternative viewing for the summer audiences not interested in big action or horror. I remember my aunt and grandma watching this one and just getting a kick out of it. I actually watched it for the first time to make this video, and I thought it was funny. It runs a little bit long, but the performances from Midler and Tomlin are highly amusing. However, to me, the silly humor did start to feel a little bit repetitive. There was enough audience appeal, however, to make this movie a success. Big Business would earn a strong $40.2 million. The budget of $20 million was a tad high for this comedy, but necessary for the 5 months of post-production needed to create all the visual effects. Sadly, though, $40 million was probably not the $50 to $60 million that Touchstone was hoping to get from this movie, given the past two summers of success that Midler had brought them. Regardless, though, whatever disappointment that Touchstone may have been feeling about the lack of box office pop from Big Business would disappear just a few weeks later when Touchstone would partner with Amblin Entertainment to deliver a film that would just capture the world's imagination and just rake in an avalanche of cash. Stepping back in time to 1981, Disney had purchased the film rights to a little book called Who Censored Roger Rabbit by Gary Wolfe. Disney had a couple of scripts written, and then they would bring in Steven Spielberg and his Amblin Entertainment, and the result would be an iconic film and the second highest grossing film of 1988.
Well, I'm sorry I yanked your ears.
All the time you yanked my ears?
Now, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was a movie that would hit the trifecta. It was a success with critics, it was adored by audiences, and it was a winner come award season set in an alternate golden era of Hollywood where humans and toons coexist. A hapless toon named Roger Rabbit is framed for a crime, and it will be up to a grumpy old detective played by Bob Hoskins to prove his innocence to the villainous Judge Doom played by Christopher Lloyd. Who Framed Roger Rabbit would splash into theaters right in June, right in the middle of the summer, to just wrangle in audiences to the theater. I remember seeing this movie in the cinema a handful of times, and it was just the four quadrant commercial hit that Touchstone needed. It would open with $11.2 million to take the number one spot. It would be a top three movie for 7 weeks, a top 10 movie for a staggering 17 weeks, and it's easy to see why. I mean, what this movie delivered, people had never seen before, with such seamless blending between human actors and cartoon characters, and Audiences loved it. Roger Rabbit was just a fixture of my childhood, and it still holds up impressively all these years later. The budget was reported to be $70 million. The production companies insisted it was only $50 million. Regardless, it would pull in $351.5 million worldwide, and it undoubtedly killed it on the home video market. The story is engaging, the humor lands, the nostalgia is just cemented in place, and it's rightfully an iconic movie in cinematic history. Now, behind the scenes at this time, Disney was already working on another source of funding. The money from the Silver Screen Partners 3 deal was beginning to run dry, so in June of 1988, Disney would strike one final deal with SSP. Silver Screen Partners 4 would be set in place, and from an estimated 52,000 investors, the partnership would raise $400 million for future films, and Touchstone and Disney would use these films not exclusively to finance movies for the next 3 years. Over on the public side, with Roger Rabbit still earning at the box office, Touchstone would drop their last big splashy hit of the summer. They had acquired a script from Universal Pictures about this college student who moonlights as a bartender, and the result, as gloriously 80s as it was end up being the 8th highest grossing film of the year.
Get the women, you get the bucks. You can see the color of their panties, and you know you got talent. Stick with me, son, I'll make you a star.
Now, Tom Cruise would have a fantastic 1988. He starred alongside Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man, a deeply emotional, layered drama that would go on to be the highest grossing movie of the year. Cruise would also tend bar in an emotionally transparent romantic drama called Cocktail alongside Brian Brown and Elizabeth Shue. Cocktail would hit theaters at the end of July, and with its vanity, its style, and its sex appeal, it would open number one with a big $11.8 million weekend, and really, it would dominate the rest of the summer. Cocktail would spend 2 weeks in the number one spot, another 12 weeks in the top 10. Critics, of course, disliked this vanity film that was just fueled on all the superficiality that the 80s had to offer, but audiences loved it. I caught pieces of this movie when I was a kid, but I really discovered it in the early 90s on cable as a teenager. I always had a huge crush on Shu, so I was just all in on this flashy coming-of-age tale of romance and mixing drinks and self-discovery. And to be honest, I still love this movie today. When I was a teen, I wanted to open my own bar. I attended bar in college because of this movie. I've drank in more than my share of red eyes, and I still quote this movie whenever possible. And with its budget of $20 million, it would go on to earn $171.5 million. And despite its flaws, you just can't deny this film's lovable charm. So once again, like they did in 87, you could say that Touchstone killed it in the summer of 88. With the success of Roger Rabbit and Cocktail, these two movies alone equated to more than $520 million of the summer box office, and you could be certain that the execs with Touchstone were riding high. But as you know, business in Hollywood is volatile, and Touchstone would follow up their summer success with three commercial failures in a row over the next few months.
Maybe they've written my father off, but I haven't.
You mean we go get
him? Why not?
I love it.
In August, they would release The Rescue, one of many teen adventure movies from the 80s. Many of these films have gone on to hold cult status, but financially at the time, they were either hit or miss, and The Rescue would be a miss. Movies like Red Dawn were able to find that balance, but the concept of the kids of Navy SEALs venturing into South Korea to rescue their fathers was a bit too much of a stretch for most people. The film had a budget of $14.5 million, and it would only earn back $5.8 million. But as I said, silly movies like these have aged better over time through a nostalgic lens. And despite its notable flaws, there is a charm to be found in this fantasy-level teen action adventure. Touchstone's next movie would land in September. It would be their first financed under the new Silver Screen Partners 4 deal, and it would not kick the loan off on a good foot. Heartbreak Hotel, written and directed by Chris Columbus, would follow a group of teenage friends who want to set up a band at high school, so they kidnap Elvis. This movie received mixed to negative reviews, and audiences were not really interested either, as it would only earned back $5.5 million of its $13 million budget. And you know, this movie never really grabbed me back in the day. I remember seeing it on cable, but it was just never a film that was in my rotation growing up.
Where's Molly?
She's not coming back to you.
What are you talking about?
Ask your boyfriend. Why don't you just ask your boyfriend why I'm taking Molly?
Then in November, Touchstone would release their annual awards attempt with a niche drama starring Diane Keaton and Liam Neeson called The Good Mother, directed by Leonard Nimoy. I had never heard of this movie before making this video, but the plot sounds a bit Oscar-baity, involving the daughter of a woman getting involved in a questionable situation with the mother's boyfriend. It really does sound like an attempt at conjuring up moral and ethical drama, but it was clearly a swing and a miss, pulling in just $4.8 million of its $14 million budget. Word of mouth was presumably not good on this movie either, and with it being the third film in a row to lose money, I'm sure Touchstone was beginning to worry just a little.
I knew it.
What? It's a staff meeting. So what?
So what? We're all screwed, that's what.
Heading into the Christmas corridor, and Touchstone Pictures was stumbling from three consecutive theatrical failures. They needed a hero, potentially a hero the studio had found success with the prior summer. Touchstone needed a hero that could save the day financially, and while he was at it, maybe save Christmas along the way, and that hero they would find.
Santa's in the slammer.
Look at those beady twinkling.
Ernest Saves Christmas would bring back the fun-loving Ernest, who has traded his dreams of being a summer camp counselor to drive a taxi, and one day Ernest is going about his business and finds that one of his riders is the real Santa Claus, and the next thing you know, Ernest is finding himself on a mission to help Santa find his successor and to save the holiday. Ernest Saves Christmas would open on November 11th and take the number two spot behind Child's Play with a solid $5.7 million weekend. Timing was naturally great for this little comedic adventure. Holiday films tend to do well, and Ernest was a known fixture in pop culture at this time, so Ernest Saves Christmas did great. I loved this movie as a kid. I watched it every year growing up, and even today, watching Ernest, Santa, and their random crew of friends just save the holiday is kind of a charming throwback to that kid inside of me who sat in front of the TV with a PB&J watching this movie and thinking about what I had under the tree. Ernest Saves Christmas would spend 6 weeks in the top 10 and earn a respectable $28.2 million on just a $6.5 million budget. And while it didn't blow the doors off the bank again, I'm sure Touchstone was finally happy to have a movie back in the green.
Caught Michael with another woman?
Yeah.
And now you're going to have a baby all on your own?
Having a baby without a father, am I being selfish? All great love is selfish.
But they weren't done. Touchstone had one last movie to deliver in 1988, and it would come on Christmas with the musical dramedy Beaches, starring Bette Midler and Barbara Hershey, directed by Gary Marshall. This movie would be a hit amongst the older crowd at the time. The market for poignant dramas with undercurrents of reflective humor were popular, and Beaches just checked all the sentimental boxes. Beaches would drop into theaters on December 21st, and it was well received. Critics were a bit lukewarm on it, but audiences, on the other hand, just loved the sentimentality of the friendships and just the emotions explored in this movie. Midler's version of Wind Beneath My Wings became a number one song and was probably more popular than this movie was at the time. That song was everywhere. I had never actually watched this movie. My family did have the other aunts and uncles over to watch it one evening. I can remember that as a kid because it was a rare thing. So when the family did that, it had to be a very popular film amongst the olds at the time. They really only did that with like Cocoon and Not Without My Daughter and a few other movies. I actually watched this movie for this video, and it's fine, I guess. It's not really my cup of tea, but I will admit that it's well written, acted, and directed. It would pull in $57 million on a $20 million budget. The soundtrack to this movie probably made a killing as well. And like the Titanic in the 90s, it seemed every house had a copy of Beaches on VHS stuffed in their oversized entertainment center. So to close out 1988, Disney Pictures, with the assistance of the Touchstone banner, had officially beaten out the other studios to sit atop the mountain of the box office receipts. With Roger Rabbit, Good Morning Vietnam, 3 Men and a Baby, and Cocktail, Disney had 4 films in the top 10 at the domestic box office that year. At this same time, several movie production studios were starting to move away from feature films and closing their doors, so Disney would use the opportunity to create another production label to fill the void. Michael Eisner's initial pitch of Hollywood Pictures from years earlier had been incorporated, and in December it would be announced for a launch of February of 1989, with Touchstone Pictures officially up and running and essentially a twin version of it in Hollywood Pictures getting up and running. Disney at this time was only growing their domination of the film market, and in the next video we'll be diving into their run of films during 1988, where Touchstone would release 8 more films. So that wraps up this video for today, guys. Thank you so much for watching. I greatly appreciate you all. I hope you have been enjoying this look back at Touchstone Pictures during the 80s. I have some other studios I want to look back at as well once we get this one wrapped up. Also, be on the lookout for my next video. It's coming real soon, right around the corner. I hope to see you guys all back for that one. And until then, movies never say die.
This is Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there.
Have a war, you gotta become war.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
You trying to say Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?